Oh, you just started again. Can we do it again? Okay. Good afternoon. This is the Subcommittee on Information Technology, Joint Committee on Ways and Means, April 16th. We have an informational meeting on three different topics, three different departments. Would you like to give us a very short 1 minute review of what we're going to do in which order?
I will. Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, members of the committee. Today we have with us the Oregon Department of Education, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and the Oregon Education Investment Board. The first two agencies do have information technology operations, either currently within their organization and or planned for the future, and so we do anticipate getting a general IT overview from those agencies, and then our last presentation is focused on a particular project, the State Longitudinal Data System that's being led by the Oregon Education Investment Board.
Okay, thank you. And I want to let the committee especially know in advance, but also those of you who are here watching, I will be leaving. It's not because of anything anybody said. I need to get prepared and leave for the hearing, out-of-town hearing of the full committee of Joint Ways and Means. Department of Education, you're first.
Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ben Tate. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon Department of Education. I want to thank you for giving me an opportunity to kind of give you an overview of our department and where we are now and where we're going in the next 2 years. So you see the agenda. We'll give you kind of a brief overview both of the department, my office within the department, and then I'm going to focus specifically on projects that we're going to be closing up in the next 2 months as the biennium ends, and projects we're looking at both in the next 2 years and then a little bit beyond that. So first off, I won't read this word for word to you. You're familiar with the Oregon Department of Education mission and values. I put this slide in here to emphasize two things. The department has a real focus now on students and a shift from being an agency of compliance to being an agency of partnership with a real focus on how do we get the districts, how do we help them to achieve the outcomes that we're all looking for. And I bring it up because my department, since I've been here, I've been in this role for the last year and a half. Since I have been here, my focus has been similar to that and focus on within IT, how can we change from kind of a compliance mentality, which we, and as IT guys, we tend to have, to a mindset of partnership and looking for those opportunities to work both with the folks within the department and our districts and ESDs to kind of help through technology further the missions that we the department has. This is just the org chart, just to emphasize my department does report directly to Rob Saxton. I sit on the management team with the other department heads, which is was a real selling point for me in considering the job because it affords me the opportunity to hear at a high level what the mission is, what the direction is for the department, and how IT can help support that. Like I said before, I feel very strongly that IT's role is one of service and partnership, and that I think having this seat at the table really helps that.
Mr. Tate, could you move the microphone away from you just a bit?
Am I a little too loud?
There's some feedback or
okay.
Something that we've
okay.
Heard about. Thank you.
Sorry about that. So this is a quick slide kind of just going over the operational budget. As you guys know, the Department of Education budget is very large, but the vast majority of that is passed through to the districts and ESDs. We roughly have about $150 million that is set aside for operations of the department. My department is slated to have about $15 million, or about 10% of that budget. With the breakdown you see there, the majority of it being general fund with a little bit of federal and other fund. Federal and other, these numbers reflect limitation, not necessarily cash flow. We do have a couple of grants and a couple of programs that largely utilize federal funds, so any work we do for those, that the funding for that would come through that. So here's just some quick facts about my department. We have four managers, including myself. 45 permanent staff. Currently, we have 9 limited durations. In a couple of months, that number will go down to 4. We have 2 projects, which I will talk about later, wrapping up, Project Alder and our class size project, which funded 5 limited duration positions. Those will all end on June 30th. So going into next biennium, we'll be looking at a staff of 49. I put who do we support, because if you look at the ratio, we have roughly 579 positions within the Department of Education. And if you do the quick math, it's roughly a 1 to 10 ratio, which if you have studied the industry, you know that's a fantastic ratio. It's a little deceptive, though, because we don't just support the department. We also provide support to our districts and ESDs for the data collections. We have 92 data collections that happen over the course of the year. And we end up interacting with nearly 3,000 district staff in working with those collections. A vast majority of my department's time is focused on the development, maintenance, and support of those data collections. Every year we go through a cycle of changes, whether it be from state legislation, federal legislation, or needs of the programs to update and modify those collections. It's a very lengthy process because we are dealing with 196 school districts, roughly 19 ESDs, all of whom work with different development companies to track their own data. So we have to be coordinating with all of those people to make sure the changes we're requesting are then conveyed to those districts who can convey it to their vendor partners and make the changes. So we've instituted a cycle of change that's a year. So anything that you request out of this legislative session, we've got a year timeline with to discuss and implement. Just because of the complexity of the scenario and the amount of people that we're dealing with. This is our vision and kind of our main 4 goals over the course of the next couple of years. And it's really, like I mentioned before, the focus really is on partnership with the department and with the districts. Before this role, I worked for Salem-Keizer School District. And so coming here, I had a real strong emphasis on how can we in the Department of Education partner and help our school districts through technology. And you see that reflected in the vision. The 4 kind of main points that we'll be emphasizing in our strategic plan for 15-17 is focusing on what I call core business. The department has a history of doing everything itself. So all of our services currently are provided internally. All of our applications are largely home developed. My question to them is, what's unique about the Department of Education as opposed to different agencies or different companies? Our data collections are very unique. We're the only ones doing those in the state. Those definitely need to be something that we focus on. Our infrastructure support is not unique. Everyone does it. Everyone uses phones, everyone uses networks, everyone uses computers. What I want to do over the next 2 years is do a review of those things to ensure that we're spending our resources in the right places. Do I need to be the one providing my network? I don't know. My gut says no. I want to do that review and make sure that we're focusing on the right place. So when I say focus on core business, that's what I mean. Identify those things that are unique and really excel at those things and find those things that aren't unique and start to look for ways to do them differently. Grow capacity. This is in tandem with that, really to focus on how can we do the things that we do uniquely better. So are there areas where we need to update our technology to process the data quicker, to handle those collections in a more efficient manner, provide services to our department and our districts in a better way. It's 2015. This is a saying I like to say. It's 2015. There's a better way to do it a lot of times than the way we're doing it now. And I want to explore that as much as possible.
I'm going to ask a question at this point. Last summer, I participated on a work group with 3 other legislators. The work group was to discuss potential opportunities and efficiencies for regional delivery of education services. And I'm wondering if you kept in touch with the work of that group and the recommendations. And the reason I'm asking is when you said it would be a good idea that you were interested in focusing on what is unique versus what others can do. It occurs to me that there's something that we talked a lot about that is probably not what you would define as unique. yet we as legislators probably would have thought you should be doing and should be providing. What makes it unique is that you're the link for everybody. Hmm. If everybody had to recreate a certain capacity or expertise in every small school district around the state, it would be much less efficient than if it's something you could do, for example. So how do you define unique? Is it the type of work it is or the position that you're in to offer service?
Chair Nathanson, thank you for the question. It is both. There are definitely things that I would consider unique because we're the only ones that do them, and unique because there is a unique need for them that we alone can provide in a way. I definitely see the same thing. There are areas that I would like to see the department grow in to help kind of provide that leadership for districts and ESDs or to link them to other resources. What you'll see a little bit right now is a focus. I'm calling 15-17 some foundational years, because there's some things that I want to get set within the department and running more efficiently. But after that, I really want to explore those areas where we can really have a much deeper impact and provide much better service to our districts and ESDs, because I definitely see the need.
Okay, thank you.
Yes,
Senator. Thank you. You know, we know that graduation rates in K-12 are inversely proportional to attendance rates. And yet, in Oregon, we pay the school districts by the average daily membership, which is the enrollment per semester. Can you walk us through how you track that currently, and then what you would have to do, if anything, different to track average daily attendance? For instance, in Texas, they do it by average daily attendance, and they actually break it down to half days. And I am convinced myself that we could do a lot for our graduation rates if we just made sure their little bottoms were in chair during school days.
Senator Wissett, Chair Nathanson, thank you. Currently, we have four collections over the course of the year, which are what we call ADM, average daily membership. So the districts at that point report quarterly what that membership is based on the formulas that we've given them. The change that you're suggesting would, from our standpoint, from a technical standpoint, just be a change in the logic of how we would ask the question. So we're essentially just asking the question differently. It would, as I kind of mentioned, that cycle of change, it would just take a little bit for us to walk through the districts that change and have them program that into their system and collect the information a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
But from a technical standpoint, The change that you're suggesting is not terribly complex. I won't comment on the policy. That's not my side. But from a technical standpoint, it's very doable.
Thank you for the answer. Appreciate it.
So the last point, or the last two points, really the lead transformation, and this gets, Chair Nathanson, to the question that you asked, that ultimately there are some of these things that I believe that as an IT department we can kind of help lead and ask the question. We are in a unique position within a department because we see all of the data that every aspect, every program individually gathers. And so we're in a unique position to raise certain issues and to raise different ways of looking at it and different ways of doing business. And I do see that as the role. It's not our position to answer the question. That's our business partners. But we are in a unique position to be able to see the question, and I think it's our obligation to raise it. And so there's several things in here that I'm going to look at over the next couple years to try and help do that. And the last piece, all of these things are really dependent on our staff. And I think it's important to really highlight that in our plan, that it takes an investment in that staff to keep them current with the technology, to keep their skills up and make sure that they're understanding the direction. Because I sure can't do this on my own. And it takes, you know, the focus of the staff within my department to accomplish these things. It does me little good to say them if we can't do them. And so I felt it was important to highlight that. So very quickly, this is just kind of an overview of some of the major areas that we focus in. Data is at the top because it really is the largest effort, I would say, of my department. We spend the majority of our time on those data collections. We have 200 databases representing different capture points for the data that we collect over those 92 data collections that we do in the course of a year. We currently build and maintain and manage all of those all of the unique applications within our department. This number includes our data collections. So if you count 92 in there of that, so we have roughly 200 additional applications that we're managing and maintaining right now. And this is the reason why I want to do that look. 200 is a very large number. And I want to take a look and see to make sure that we're doing things in the most efficient way possible. Very quickly, we've got roughly 1,500 desktops that our staff use that we support. We provide all of the help desk support, the infrastructure, and then security. And security is a focus for us given the nature and the confidentiality of the data that we're handling. So we treat that very carefully in how we deal with that, FERPA being the big issue or the big set of rules that we must abide by. But we also deal with HIPAA and CGIS because of some of the programs that we work with. So now I'm going to transition into a couple of projects. So the two that are closing this year, Project Alder and Class Size. Project Alder was is a five-year federal grant that we had that focused on four major outcomes. Consolidating and expanding access to early childhood, which for us was rolling out a product we called TS Gold to the early childhood providers that the state directly funds, so our Head Start programs and our OPK programs. This allowed us to have a central point to collect the data of the kids in those programs. Creating an instructional unit ID to allow a link between students and classes. This was important because it led directly into our ability to do class size, which I'll talk about in a moment. Increasing the quality and efficiency of data exchanges with institutions of higher education. This one, the path changed midway into the project because OEIB was formed, and part of their formation was to create a state longitudinal data system, which essentially had the same objective. So we've focused in the last year of what can we do with the resources afforded us by this grant to set up OEIB to be successful in their efforts. And finally, creating a comprehensive statewide data quality plan. We had for 4 of the 5 years of the grant, we had to team out helping to educate districts on how to manage their data so that the quality that we received was significantly higher. 3 of these 4, I would say, were very successful. Consolidating, expanding the early childhood, the data link between students and classes, and the data quality all were very successful in their objectives. We did have a few issues with what was, I would call, objective 3. Part of it because we did not establish an effective governance methodology, and so we kind of got stuck a couple of times wrestling with some of the complex issues that we had. And then with kind of the change in direction we had once OEIB's project kind of was launched, we shifted a little bit of our focus. So we're not going to do exactly what the original intent is, but I think we're going to have a product and set up OEIB to be successful in their efforts. So from that standpoint, I would definitely call this successful, just not what we originally envisioned when the grant was awarded. And this will finish in June of 2015. Class size was something that came out of the 2013 session. It was a focus on getting an average class size per district. We utilized the work we had done in Project Alder and we're expanding on that with this effort to be able to link within each district the number of kids in each class, and then we're going to provide an average, and that will be on the report card that we publish next school year. So in August of next year, when that report card comes out, we will have that average class size data on it. Those are the two main large I forgot about report card. I got to forget about this. So report card is something we do every year, and I highlighted it here because we did some fairly significant changes to it in this past year. We pulled together a group of stakeholders from our districts and ESD partners and talked to them about what would be beneficial in telling their story. And so as a part of that, we made some rather significant changes and providing what we called a supplementary data collection, which was fairly open-ended. We allowed them to tell stories about their after-school programs, about some of the numbers that they felt were important to their district, career and technical ed, school readiness, and wellness. And so we changed that up, and we changed up kind of how we presented some of the data so that it was more meaningful to our parents. We wanted to make sure that the folks that were out there receiving this data knew what they were getting, knew what it meant, and heard the story that the schools wanted to tell. We also launched in partnership with Chalkboard what we called the Open Books Project, which was basically just taking those report cards and having them on a website that was easier to kind of manipulate and compare the data. And that is out there and published. Over the next year, we're going to be looking with Smarter Balanced. We've obviously got some changes to what we're going to be reporting in this next year with the potential of kind of suspending those results for the use of assessment and accountability. We'll need to take that into a factor on the report cards. So there will be some significant changes that we're looking at for this next year as well.
Mr. Chair. Madam Chair.
Senator.
Thank you. If you go back one slide, I wanted to on your class size, I wanted to just make a point. Average class size, I'm sure, is a very useful metric. But if you spend some time in schools, you'll find that the class size within the school are quite disparate. And students tend to choose the best teachers. And if you have, say, a good science teacher, an excellent science teacher, and one who might not be so excellent, I know of one particular school where that the disparity runs about 43-21. It's 43 because you can only get 43 chairs in the classroom. And she is that good.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, that's another thing that you might want to, if you can take it another step.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator. That's a good point. So for the 15-17, we really only have one what I would consider major project, which is what we're currently calling the Early Learning Information System. And this is a little bit of a misnomer because right now our effort is to focus on replacing a database system that the Early Learning Division has to track their facilities and programs, and then add the quality rating improvement system that they're implementing as part of their Race to the Top grant. So this system is really just about facilities and programs, and that's going to be the focus for us over the next 2 years, is converting that application that currently exists, adding some additional data points to it, and then working through the data collection cycle we'll need to keep that information up to date. This is entirely funded by Race to the Top, which has a deadline of December 31st, 2016, so that is our current target. For the future, though, I wanted to highlight a couple of things that are kind of on our roadmap. So beyond 15-17, as I mentioned before, I am launching into a review of our services, which I believe will end with us having kind of a request of doing things differently in terms of our applications and potentially our infrastructure. So there will be some things that we're considering which may require a little bit of additional investment. We have to do that work now to do the review, see what's out there, see what the possibilities are, and ensure that we're making the best decision, both in terms of efficiency and cost effectiveness. When OEIB's SLDS project does launch, we do have a support role in that, and so there will be some work and effort designed towards helping them and supporting them in that effort. And I wanted to highlight one that we've been participating in the planning of. The Department of Forestry and Secretary of State are working on a cross-agency project to do a joint e-procurement effort, and we are participating with them right now in the planning with an eye towards joining more substantially with that solution in the 2017-2019 biennium. It's something that I think fits very well with doing business better and more efficient. And if there are other agencies that are, procurement is similar in all of our agencies, we're all doing the same thing. So it makes sense to me to look at a common solution to do that. So we are participating with them in the planning right now with the intent of working very closely in 2017. And that concludes my overview. I'm happy to take any questions or highlight anything else that you are interested in.
Madam Chair, I just had one other question. It has to do with virtual learning. Does your shop work with the virtual learning and the distance learning in the school districts? And if so, what are you doing?
So I am not directly involved with the Oregon Virtual School District. That's part of one of our programs. However, the assistant superintendent that's over that, Jim Carlisle, does talk with me quite a bit about kind of a direction. So we're in an advisory capacity of that and kind of helping them identify ways that they can help the school districts, but I'm not directly involved.
Thank you.
Is that all? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ready to move to the next, which is Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson, Co-Chair Riley, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ben Cannon. I'm the Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Appreciate the opportunity to be here with you. I'll see if we can pull up the perhaps.
I'm just so tempted to say welcome the honorable
formerly honorable.
I think formerly honorable.
I think you're still honorable.
Ex-honorable. thank you. So unlike our predecessor who could assume that you knew the Oregon Department of Education, I'm not sure we can or should assume that you know the Oregon Higher Education Coordinating Commission. We are a relatively new entity and in the process of transition as we come to reflect really a merger of higher education agencies. So a little bit about who we are and what we do. In the budget that your Ways and Means and legislature will consider, we propose the sort of complete integration of our of state agency staff that have historically been housed in separate agencies, separate departments with separate IT structures and systems and other operational systems. Those exist today in the Oregon Student, the Office of Student Access and Completion in Eugene, in CCWD here in Salem, at the Oregon University System in its last months, located at several parts of the state, and in the private post-secondary office that historically was housed at OSAC and the Oregon Department of Education, but has come under the HEC banner. So really, why I am presenting to you, in the past, this presentation would have been, you would have needed to hear from at least four state agencies to describe their IT work associated with higher education. Today, you'll hear just from me, but because we're in the process of transitioning, we've not completed this merger, I felt the need to bring the people sitting behind me from the four units, four more units that we are incorporating. And if there are questions, I may very well call on them to describe their IT work. So we have leads from each of these organizations. Likewise, 2 years from now, as this sort of integration is complete, I think you could expect that there will be a single IT director for this integrated agency that would be able to really and fully express the integrated IT system that, and organization that we've created. Just so you get maybe a little clearer visual sense of what this looks like, our agency consists of several offices, and they're reflected on this slide. These are what are proposed within the budget that is under consideration now. The first two of these on the left-hand side, policy and operations and research and data, are where we'll see the most integration. So whereas the remainder, the following four are sort of legacy offices reflecting OSAC, CCWD, the pieces of OUS that we, or portions of OUS that we inherit in our private post-secondary unit. Policy and operations, which is where IT will sit, will be a combined office that shares the resources that we sort of pull from these and creates more efficiency and effectiveness in the resources that we pull from the four others that are coming beneath the HEC umbrella. Likewise, our Office of Research and Data will be a single shop that stores and uses higher education student level data from our public community colleges, our public universities in particular. Really, this slide expresses that these points that that historically we have been separate, that we are in the process of coming together. And that includes integrated sort of network as well as integrated data system that contains records for Oregon's higher education students. This is what the proposed staffing structure for an integrated information technology office within the Higher Education Coordinating Commission looks like. This is an organizational chart with positions listed. Some of those are general funded. Those are the ones that are in darker colors. Some of those are funded primarily from federal or other funds. And some of these are requested through new packages within our, or at least one of these new packages within our proposed budget. We are about one-fifth the size of Oregon Department of Education. So the general fund support that goes into our staffing, the core agency staffing, runs the tune of 12 to 15 million. It sort of depends what you would count within our agency staffing versus the dollars, the $1.7 billion, close to $1.7 billion that we put out to institutions of higher education into Oregon Opportunity Grants. But our total sort of staffing and agency operations constitutes is about one-fifth the size of ODE. Likewise, our IT budget reflected here comes sort of in that realm of approximately 20% of the size of what you've heard before. Within our GRB for 2015-17, there is roughly $2.3 million of general fund for IT operations and systems. There is also an additional request for approximately $1 million. It's in part a placeholder request as we complete the business case for a significant upgrade to our financial aid management system that the Office of Student Access and Completion oversees and operates. Well, what does IT do within higher education and within the HEC? Well, really divide this among two functions. One is really the internal function that our IT offices support. That includes providing desktop support for our staff, 100-plus FTE in these various offices. It includes providing support to our research and data staff that work principally with our community college and public university data. And it provides support to the folks who distribute the dollars, which is one of our core functions. We do so on the basis of data, and it is our IT staff that helps ensure that that data is available to our fiscal staff for the purposes of distributing to our campuses. Likewise, we have external customers, if you will, including institutional researchers at campuses that make use of the data that we maintain. The public and media, the legislature, our workforce providers, local workforce providers around the state, the colleges and universities, financial aid offices, the institutions themselves, and the federal government, who we report to for a number of purposes. I'll note just a few of the major IT systems that come under the HEC umbrella. I mentioned our proposed upgrade to the first of these, the financial aid management information system at the Office of Student Access and Completion. And just so folks are clear, this is the office that receives from the federal government each and every one of the FAFSAs that Oregon students submit to the federal. That's the federal application for financial aid that students submit to the federal government when they select as one of their potential college choices in Oregon institution. Our offices receive those, that they become the basis for how we award Oregon Opportunity Grants, the state's need-based financial aid program. And so this is a many hundred thousand student record system that we maintain and put to good purposes. The second of these also is key. It is the OCRS, to use the acronym, Oregon Community College's Unified Reporting System, which is the basis for all of the records, all the data that the state maintains associated with student enrollment and completion at our community colleges. So our 17 community colleges report to us on a regular basis about enrollment, about demographics, about progress towards completion, about certificates and degrees. We maintain that within a unified system. We are in the process of developing and upgrading that system, and I'll speak to that in a moment. Moving more quickly down the list, we have significant data systems associated with the state's oversight of federal workforce programs that CCWD is responsible for in partnership with local workforce boards. Our Office of University Coordination inherits from the Oregon University System a state data system that contains student records, again, student-level records related to enrollment and completion, progress and completion for Oregon public university students, course approval database, a private post-secondary database with information that we collect from private colleges and universities in the state, and, of course, our file servers, email services, and website support for across the organization. A couple of our major IT projects from the current biennium, the soon-to-conclude biennium, we've begun to develop a new data system and reporting system for community college data. This would be a sort of outgrowth of our ACCRS system. It's called D4A. It's been developed in partnership with the community colleges. Think it will provide the public, our researchers, the college researchers and staff with an exceptional opportunity to better understand and make use of the data that's reported to the state related to community college students. We are in the process of updating our servers and at CCWD and beginning to develop an integrated HEC IT infrastructure. We are beginning to create a consolidated post-secondary data warehouse that would combine our community college and public university student records. And we are beginning to create a private post-secondary database that is significantly more robust than what we've had before in order to support our efforts to support private institutions and regulate our private proprietary institutions of higher education in Oregon. Last couple of slides, a few projects that are in the works. Several of these involve the development of a new consolidated HEC agency. That includes, as I noted at the organizational chart slide, the integration of our IT staff from several agencies to one, the integration of our network and desktop support into a single agency structure, the upgrading and replacement of our old financial aid management system that's in our policy option request, and potential programming changes to reflect possible changes to the administration of the Opportunity Grant. A few more here. These are primarily related to the development of our integrated higher education student record system that is in the works. We look forward to the ability to look at community college student data and public university student data is within the same system with a single query. We can't do that today. We have to go separately to two separate systems. But given the increasing numbers of Oregon students who move between the two systems or are enrolled in both of the systems, there are significant benefits, I think, to us and to our commission, to you, and to the public to being able to understand that experience better. And so the creation of a single integrated higher education data warehouse will be important for our future work and yours. I'll just note there, because I just find this so fascinating and surprising when I heard it, that the majority of our resident students who received bachelor's degrees from an Oregon public university last year began at a community college. So the majority. It's just we have in our mind, we tend to have in our mind this conception of a four-year university student, right? They start as a freshman, they complete in 4 years. Well, one, they don't complete in 4 years, unfortunately. And many students, it's taking longer than that. But number two, the majority of them actually don't start in a public university. They're starting in a community college, and we could talk a lot about the reasons for that. They actually do very well.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd really like to have more of those stats. I'd like to have an idea of how many of them are traditional students. In other words, are they're starting their community college as soon as they graduate from high school, but then they go off for 4, 5, or 6 years and come back and finish it at U of O or PSU. I'd like to have a sense of what that what those demographics are like, as well as, if possible, some of the more traditional demographics that you might find. You know, where are they from? Where is the, what schools are really seeing a lot of those students? I would anticipate that, you know, PSU, because it's a city campus, you're going to see more folks coming in than perhaps OIT, but you never know. I guess Oregon Tech is how they would prefer it right now. But I'd like to just have a sense of that. It's the these are the kinds of things that we keep running into, and I run into with non-traditional students. I see a lot of non-traditional students now.
Representative Frederick, Co-Chair Riley, we'd be very happy to follow up with more information about who these students are, where they come from, and what their experiences are. You're absolutely right. Portland State University in particular sees many, many of these transfer students, and they do come from all walks of life. They include traditionally aged college students, but there are also many older adults who begin higher education at a community college and transfer to a university. There are a fair number of students, interestingly, not nearly as many, but who take university courses and transfer to community colleges or are enrolled in both. So I'd be happy to provide that to you.
If you could provide that through the committee administrator so we could all have that, that'd be great. Senator Woods, did you have?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Cannon. I think the transferability of credits is seminal to this whole operation. And whether they're AP credits or dual enrollment credits, they are pretty much transferable. But what we're running into the problem that several universities are a little parochial about whether they are transferable as a core credit or as an elective credit. And if you've taken physics at a community college or as a senior high school or whatever, and that is a core course that you have to take in college and is not recognized, then you've wasted your time. So would you talk a little about how we can address that?
Senator Witt said, Co-Chair Riley, I'm so very pleased you asked the question because I think it is quite central to the responsibilities and the opportunities for a coordinating commission like ours to address those types of issues that can emerge between different parts of our higher education system and higher education in K-12 when it comes to credit transfer. One of the ways in which we will measure our success as a commission is the extent to which students experience higher education more seamlessly, which means to say that unnecessary obstacles aren't put in front of them when they attempt to transfer. I received from your neck of the woods a resolution adopted by the Klamath Community College Board of Directors expressing concern about some of the barriers that their students have found when they've attempted to transfer credits to public universities in the state. So what can we do? Well, this legislature, I should say prior legislatures, but the legislature has adopted legislation on this to try to address the very issue that you described. There was a transfer student bill of rights, for example, that tasks now us, the HEC, with establishing policies and norms to ensure that credit transfer is smooth. So we're prepared to take that up. There's been additional legislation introduced this session that would amend or strengthen that bill, and we're prepared to work with the legislature and, importantly, the institutions to ensure that we're not seeing credit loss where it's avoidable or unnecessary. One of our first steps in that, and it's work that we've begun already, is to try to discern exactly how large the problem is. I believe the most frequent issue that that students experience is, I think, really actually the one that you were describing, where courses completed at a high school or a community college are regarded as electives. Mm-hmm. They don't count for them by the university when they mm-hmm. go to transfer. They don't count towards the major, and as a result, don't end up being very useful to the student. We need to bear down on that, understand the extent to which that's occurring, and the extent to which some of that is reasonable. There are, in fact, elective courses, right? So it's a complicated issue. We're certainly eager to work on it.
Follow up. Yes, I think there's a legitimate concern on the part of some universities, depending on the course of study, that a AP physics course in Bonanza, Oregon, may not be equivalent to a a freshman in a physics course at Oregon State or University of Oregon. And I think the equivalency is another thing that has to, we have to look at. One of those things is our current K-12 education system requires a master's in education, but it doesn't require a master's in the course. And I think it would, to me, it makes a whole lot better sense to have require a master's in the course that you're teaching or the course subject that you're teaching. And in that case, then you would have a more of equivalency, at least in the instruction in the course. And I think that's one of the things they're doing in Texas. It's working quite well, and it takes them a while to shift over. They're encouraging teachers to get a master's in their course study, their course of teaching, and they're also giving those teachers preference in hiring. But it's, I don't think you can fix it through legislation, because I think there are we can direct it through legislation, but I don't think we can. We have to also address the cause of why the universities are not are reluctant to accept those courses.
Senator Whitsitt, Co-Chair Riley, thank you. I appreciate the points and the emphasis on transferability, since, again, it is, I think, squarely within our responsibilities as a commission to deal with those issues.
Thank you very much. One more, Representative Nierman.
So I noticed you're talking about creating a data warehouse there, and it looks to me from your slides that you're thinking you're going to host that in-house then. So is that true? And then why did you not choose to use DAS ETS to do that? So,
Thank you. For the record, my name is David Zerbe. I'm the CCWD Director of Operations, which will be the Director of Operations for
HEC. And the real HEC nerd, right?
Yes. Well, the real ones are actually behind me. I'm kind of a reform nerd. Actually, as we do this,
you can be reformed.
Chair Riley, Representative Nierman, actually what we're doing is on that project is threefold. We are buying a rack at Easy Street, so that's to put all the data in one place. It's currently not there. That will be at Easy Street. We are actually purchasing services with ETS to deal with all of the infrastructure for HEC. We currently have that in house, and we're moving that out of house to DAS. There actually it's going to be at Easy Street. Just so happens where that's going to be located. Let's see, what was the other part of your question? I think that was
why didn't you choose ETS?
Well, we did. We did
for your networking, but not for your data storage. So,
and that's okay. Only because the data is, we already have some of that data already at Easy Street, and we're just moving it all there. Part of that is because the data is actually more secure there with some of the vendor controls we have up there. So we've kept it in a secure place. And they also have insurance, so if there is any data breach, the state will not have to pay for it, but they will be paying for any of the data breach costs.
Good, thank you.
So, Sean, did you have something to add?
Senator Riley, Representative Nierman, another facet of this conversation that the Legislative Fiscal Office and DAS has had with this particular agency is that in addition to providing services at the State Data Center, the Enterprise Technology Services Division does have contracts with a variety of, I'll call them, cloud services providers, including Easy Street up in Portland. And so they have a contract with that firm. They have used that firm for development test and production systems. And so it was jointly decided that this was a workable solution for the needs of the HEC and CCWD for this project.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So next we've got the Oregon Education Investment Board. Good to see that an IT person knows how to run the computer.
Thank you very much. For the record, committee members,
Chair Riley and committee members. My name is Peter Tromba, and I'm the Policy and Research Director for the Oregon Education Investment Board. And just for full disclosure, former high school and middle school principal and teacher in the K-12 system, and I've also worked, as has Ben Tate, as an IT director in a school district. And what I'm here to present to all of you is not about our agency's IT infrastructure, but instead about a specific project that actually came about with the inception of the OEIB. But I think just for consistency's sake, I'd like everyone to know that we do not have an IT structure at OEIB because we're a tiny agency. We have 15 folks, and actually we purchase our IT services from the Oregon Department of Education, and I'd like to shout out that they do a great job supplying our desktop support, file backup and things like that to our agency. Most of what the folks do at OEIB has to do with policy, and then my department has to do with research, specifically what research that we can do to make sure that we're doing the best job we can in Oregon to spend wisely, implement the right kinds of programs that lead to equitable outcomes for all students, and that we review those on an ongoing basis and progress monitor what we do P through 20 in our system. And at the inception of the OEIB, the legislation that created it included direction for our agency to create a longitudinal data system that would allow us to measure at the student level outcomes for students and investments that we'd made in students. So my first slide mentions that it's in statute. The second sphere here, or oval, or whatever it is really important to understand why student level data. I get asked this question a lot. Why don't you use aggregated data, which would be pretty simple to get? We see aggregated data all the time from ODE or higher ed or OUS or whatever. Why do you need student level data? And the reason you need student level data is because in order to really understand the trajectory and the influences of something like career technical education program or a extra reading intervention that a school district is using, or maybe a fifth year program for high school students moving on to college, you have to be able to identify which students received what treatment. And also, if you're interested in demographic characteristics of the student and whether or not our system creates opportunities for some groups of students and a lack of opportunities for others, you need to know something about who those students were. What was their gender? What was their race and ethnicity? What was their status in a number of other senses? And you can only do analysis like that with longitudinal data, with student-level data. Second thing is, we often see in education, and even our wonderful Oregon report card and lots of other things we all look at, suffers from the fate of looking at an individual institution with a snapshot, and every year looking at the fifth graders in a school, and then the next year's fifth graders in that school, and the next year's fifth graders in that school. And if the school is small enough, even if the institution, community college or university cohort, small enough that you're looking at, those snapshots don't really tell a story because the kids are different or the young adults are different. The only real way you can follow is by growth and comparing individual students to themselves year after year after year after they receive education or programs or services. So you need student level data, and you got to follow individual students through the pathway, which means longitudinal data. And so the last bullet basically is just reaffirming the idea that the reason it was created in statute for OEIB was to do these things. Another question you might have, though, is, well, why OEIB? You've got ODE back here. They had this project Alder. Why don't they do it? Or why doesn't higher ed do it? They've got lots of smart people that do institutional research. The issue is, in state after state after state across the United States, the thing that gets you on longitudinal databases in terms of doing them well is not IT. It's governance and it's politics. It's fairly easy to put together records of students and trace and answer and ask questions. And whether it's easy to use that data and make a difference with programs, I think, is something a lot of us just want to think about more. But it's pretty easy to build longitudinal databases. What's really hard is to get the data. So when the Oregon Department of Education is running a project and they need to get data from community colleges or the universities, or vice versa, and there's disagreement about how that should be supplied or how many characters should first names have or how do we define race and ethnicity, all those kinds of questions, if there is not an arbiter to decide, yes, no, A or B, five letters or six letters, what can happen is programs literally break down under the weight of unmade decisions. And that's actually the case in many statewide longitudinal data solutions that have not been successfully implemented across the United States. And I'd include Oregon to some degree in that description. So when the OEIB was conceived at that moment, what was also realized is the OEIB could be the governance for that. The chief education officer could be a tiebreaker, as it were. When the K through 12 and the higher ed can't agree, you could have that tie-breaking capability. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the accomplishments of the project, is we have seen that that particular function has worked so far. So I wanted to start with accomplishments that have happened so far, and then we'll talk about risks. At the very end of this presentation is maybe the most interesting part. I was going to stick it in the front, but I feel like it'd be good to leave you thinking at the very end about the why. What can we do with this database? But what are the accomplishments so far? Well, first off, February 2013, our office presented an initial business case to the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, and that business case had the strong support from all the major educational agency and field stakeholders throughout the state, as well as a lot of other interested parties who gave tremendous amount of support at that time. However, at that moment, right when we were presenting the business case, another thing that was happening in Oregon was that we were implementing a process of IT management over projects that required projects to go through a more rigorous staged gate process, so that you wouldn't move a project to be implemented until you were positive, or pretty darn positive, you knew how much it was going to cost, how long it was going to take, and exactly what it was going to deliver. And the stage gate process is a tighter and tighter and tighter window that you need to fit through until you finally get your implementation dollars. And where we are as a project is we've gone through the first of those gates, and we're preparing for the next. And that's been the body of our work since that first business case has been fine-tuning actually our project cost and scope and schedule. We've had an independent quality review and assessment from someone not a member of the state, which is obviously a great process, and that's provided us great insight about what we're doing right, what we're not doing right, where there's risks, and where we need to mitigate those risks. One decision that came out of that initial quality assessment was to have our plan take place in phases. And it may be that we have enough time today to delve into some particular detail about the project, but to suffice to say that when it was originally presented to the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee a year and a half ago, we had conceived the project as having a couple of pieces to it that were really going to be implemented simultaneously or developed simultaneously. In fact, the external review, as well as reviews from LFO and also CIO's office, have really and actually reflection by the project team and our partners at ODE and the HEC, we've realized that we need to phase our project. Let's get the most important thing and the easiest thing done first, and then let the second part of it happened second. It made a lot more sense, and so we're working on that phased plan in a revised business case, which is currently in process. I mentioned the data governance structure. So Ben Cannon, Rob Saxton, and Nancy Golden, who are the chief executives to the major agencies involved, meet on a quarterly basis, and they govern a lot of the work that we do. We also have a monthly steering committee, which has representatives from the field and the major agencies, and that governance plan's made a big difference in being able to move forward on some thorny issues that used to stop us. Ben Tate mentioned a little while ago Project Alder, and Project Alder hardware and software, which is still very viable and has some life in it, is going to make it over to the OEIB as a resource for the project, and it will be at the State Data Center. And will be a place that's first tour of duty is going to be as a sandbox to be able to for us to be able to work in to do some of the work that we need to do. So that's a resource that will continue on in its intended purpose of forwarding longitudinal data systems in the state of Oregon. We have a data dictionary, which seems boring and dry as toast, but actually ends up being pretty important. What are the data elements we're going to collect, and how do you define them? And what we're doing right now is a dry run. OEIB doesn't currently have any computers to put data on. We're waiting for the Alder stuff. So when we ask for data from ODE, we don't really get it. We pretend like we're going to get it, but we do it as if it were real, as a dry run to see, well, really, could we get all of the data that we're asking for, yes or no? So we're in the process of doing that. Representative Frederick and OEIB co-convened a student data privacy work group over the last year-ish. And I was really, really happy with that work, and crossed my fingers that it comes to fruition in a number of different ways to make sure that as we advance research in data, we are also making sure to protect the privacy of student data, have concerns about access to that, and other concerns.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you for mentioning that. I just want to thank you again. I've done it publicly a couple of times, but your work and your team's work was just extraordinary, and I think we are going to be seeing that moving through the Senate and the House, and I think we'll get something that will, in fact, show give a renewed sense of confidence, I hope, for students and student privacy data. This is a real important issue, and a number of parents and a lot of other folks are very concerned about it. So thank you again for the work you've done.
Chair Riley, Rep. Frederick, the feeling's mutual. Thank you very much. I think it's a great win for Oregon. Finally, one big thing that's been going on, I'll refer to it a little bit later, but we have a research and policy center over at OEIB. It's just a couple of employees, but we call it a center because someday it'll maybe be bigger or leverage more of statewide assets. And we've not been idle waiting for the OEIB database to be built. We've actually had access to specifically the K-12 data so that our researchers can use that data to already begin analyzing what's going on in the K-12 system. And also to be able to sharpen their skills, their analytical skills, their thinking skills, their technology skills, so that when we do have a P-20, preschool through college and career database, the folks at OEIB would know how to use it, how to bring that power to bear in important questions. And that's the longest slide by far. So.
Representative Frederick.
I'm going to have to apologize. I'm trying to be in two places at the same time, and I can't do that. And we have not created a transporter beam yet that I know of. So I'm going to head off. But I want to thank you again, and I'll talk with you a little later about some of these other issues. Thanks again. Thank you very much, too, Ben. Ben's where the Ben. Oh, there we are.
I think Ben Cannon is working on that transporter. I've
he
heard.
Is.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Good. So. Glad to hear it. Coming up. Thank you. Thanks again. Take care.
So with all those accomplishments, it's always important in a project like this, and I realize that more and more in the time that I spend in the position that I hold now, when the public trust is so critical that we do things right, is consider what the risks are. One risk about this project, it's a two sides of a coin. When we did the original business case, one of our ideas was, let's do it at the least cost possible. And the least cost possible way to do a database project like this is to do a federated system. A federated system relies on the partner databases to do the heavy lift, to collect the data, to get the data scrubbed and cleaned and all up to snuff. And then you're a consumer, as the OEIB, we're a consumer of the ODE data and a consumer of the higher ed data. That's a federated system. It makes a lot of sense. Lots of states choose it. The one trick to it is it requires tremendously effective, timely coordination between the agencies. And in fact, the project management paradigm methodology that you need for a single agency-led program project versus one that has multi-agencies turns out to be quite different. So one risk in this whole project is the three-ring circus that is the OEIB SLDS, which is involving the age of the bends that you just heard from before, involving all of us together in a single enterprise moving forward. And the second note there is just data availability. That really is an outgrowth of the first one, but it's important that we make sure that we have available data. And things change. For instance, at higher ed, if you think about the change over the last year, not only have we formed a higher ed coordinating commission, but we've also given the public four-year universities their own governing boards, which may have an effect on data availability. So that's a constant question that comes up for either side of this is, how do we make sure that we have that data availability when we don't really control the supply chain from the original owner of the data all the way up? We have partners who do it. And then, as Rep. Frederick alluded to, the concerns about data privacy, access, and security. And the last one is the OEIB capacity. Honestly, we're a small agency. We don't have the horsepower that ODE or the HEC or a number of other agencies, DAS, CIO's office, or others, bring to bear to a project like this. Some of our agencies have a stable of project managers. And if one of them were to go down with the measles, there'd be somebody to maybe take on some of that work. We don't. In most of the positions in our agency, there's one of each person, one of each job type, and there's no IT infrastructure. So one thing that's been difficult for us to work through is making sure that the capacity of OEIB is sufficient to make the project go. And if it's not, can that capacity be purchased as a service? Can we leverage a partner? Or are there other ways to make it happen? And obviously, we have to come up with ways to make it happen for the project to go. The governance I've alluded to before, all I want to say about this is the little slide that's got the vertical writing over the side. We've got a governance structure that's hierarchical, but we also have a parallel structure that's about progress monitoring. And that's my K-12 school version for what it is. Progress monitoring is a helper and a gatekeeper when you're in schools. Our helper and gatekeeper are the CIO's office and LFO, and we meet every 2 weeks, literally, with a team that of IT folks that involve a number of different agencies to watch the project development, give feedback, give direction. And sometimes that drives us crazy, and sometimes it's the best help ever. But what's nice about having a critical friend with a sharp pencil is that we're not going to get in front of we're much less likely to go towards implementation with a project that's not ready. So I just want to acknowledge the partnership that we've had already with those two agencies and expect it to continue into the future. Really quickly, this is what the program looks like. These are the four major data systems. I've been pretty silent about the one on the right, the OED, Oregon Employment Department. They've been a partner that's been totally low maintenance. They supply their data. It's pretty simple stuff from their PRISM system. It's fairly restricted in what it tells us about workforce outcomes, and when it's needed, it's been provided to us in the past, and they're a great partner with Community College and Workforce Development and with HEC in general in terms of being a data sharer. So those are the four major sources. And the idea is that we take that data in at OEIB in an operational data store. We match it, which is a really tricky piece of work to match records that come across all these different sectors, because people might fill their name in as Charlie, Chuck, Chaz in the different places where they've signed up. Their name might become hyphenated through marriage. They might move around. And the fidelity and power of a research database is to a large extent derived from the extent to which you've got good matching and no false or fewer false positives and fewer false negatives. And if your matching algorithm makes systematic mistakes that exclude students of poverty or students with last names that start with Z or whatever, you're not going to get research on the back end. So that second bullet is actually really, really important and something we've spent a ton of time on considering how we would do it. De-identification means taking the data. Once it's been linked into a longitudinal record, some of these longitudinal records will be K to OSU. Some of them might be just third grade to eighth grade. There'll be all kinds of different longitudinal records, all of which add value to this research set, and all of which can be de-identified, because once you get to the point of creating the longitudinal record, you don't want to know the name. You don't want to know the address. You don't want any of that stuff. And as a matter of fact, you don't even want to be able to intuit or infer who that person may have been because of a search that you've done. So the process of de-identification is also a process of making sure that even the searches that are done later don't give you some kind of a cell, some kind of an answer where somebody could figure out who the identified, who the individuals were and identify them. And I put all those in orange because all that process in orange are going to be done by secure state workers, never be outside of, you know, out to the public in any way. But when you get to the blue at the bottom, that's intended to be a tool totally de-identified that could be used by you, that could be used by agency personnel, by people in a school, or by the public, just like the Oregon Department of Education supplies data to the public.
Senator Whitsitt?
I thank you. Mr. Trump, I have to apologize. I, too, have to be in Gresham at 7. I'm really pleased to see you in the position you're in. I think that the management of schools is probably the most underestimated attribute and, in my opinion, the most important attribute of the schools. And your work at North Eugene certainly indicated that you knew what you were doing, and you know what is good management. I have the privilege of representing a large district with a lot of school districts in a lot of disparate areas. They all get the same amount of money. Some of them are thriving, some of them are failing, and it's primarily due to school management. So thank you. Again, I apologize for having to leave in the middle of your presentation.
Well, thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Senator Rice. Senator Whitsitt, thank you very much, and for the shout out for the Highlanders. So. So the point I wanted to make at the bottom is the policy and research tool is really meant to be a state resource, and it's great to just build off on that comment. I was a high school principal who defended my welding program, my woods program, or our woods program, welding program, culinary arts program, and other CTE programs. And every year when the budget cuts came down, the pressure was on to cut those in favor of more reading and more high-level math. And I've got no problem with high-level math. I'm a STEM person myself. And in fighting for CTE, it would have been amazing to show some of the outcomes that occur for that investment. And this is exactly the kind of tool we need, because right now we can't tell that in Oregon. We don't know the value of CTE except anecdotally. I am not going to say a word about the next couple of slides. They're really just there for your information. But what they show is that ODE for 10 years of longitudinal data at the Oregon University system with 25 plus years of longitudinal data, community colleges with 5 plus years, and the Oregon Employment Department for 2 plus years, they've been answering all kinds of questions that have enabled their agencies to make better decisions in the work that they do. And then the point of this is by weight of evidence to argue that longitudinal data systems are nothing new under the sun. It's just this is a longer one, but no different than what's being done literally for decades in our state to make better policy decisions. What I do want to end with is hopefully provocative, which will get folks thinking about, well, what would you answer if you had one of these? First off, 40-40-20. Every year we're asked by the legislature to give an update on how we're doing with 40-40-20. And you might think that that's something we can push a button. It's not. It actually takes not just data collection, but some reasoning by approximation and by sort of guesstimation in some ways on what some of the numbers mean that we get from the census or from the clearinghouse of post-secondary, student clearinghouse, and other information we have to know what 40-40-20 is, because we don't have a longitudinal system that could track that better. So this would enable tracking it better. And even if we weren't at 40-40-20, if we were at 30-50-20 or whatever it is, we'd still want to know, right? Well, this is going to enable us to figure out after high school what are the long-term outcomes.
So when are you going to start collecting birth records and figuring out, you know, where those kids end up?
Chair Riley, at this point, there is nothing envisioned within this system to create a collection of anything having to do with things like birth records. Now, at ODE, there's an early learning division. Mm-hmm. And as Ben Tate mentioned, they have an early learning data system, but it's just about daycares and pre-K institutions, not about students. There are states that assign an ID at birth and keep that ID all the way through the career of that person in the state to determine the effect of services well beyond education, health and human services and the like. That is not within the scope of this project. Many would like it to be because you can see the power of it, but there's all kinds of unintended possible consequences. Mm-hmm. The type of data that we're familiar with working with in education is protected under one law, FERPA. The data having to do with medical records is a whole different data set. It's a big complication to the right. equation. Great right. question. It's not in scope to our project right
Good.
Now.
Thank you.
Okay, great. We are interested in knowing how regions or institutions are progressing according to metrics on our achievement compacts. Whether or not you like the achievement compacts or not, if you've heard stuff about that across the state, the metrics folks feel really good about. Third grade reading, a lot of folks bank on that. One thing that's really interesting is how does kindergarten readiness play out to college completion? And actually what we're finding nationwide is a lot of things that happen very early in life do matter long, long term. So we might be able to look at that. Rural and urban, does your proximity to a community college in terms of miles affect completion? Or your birthplace's proximity? There's all kinds of questions that might change policy about that having to do with regional stuff. I mentioned before return on investment. How much are we spending versus how much are we getting out of that? We've done that analysis at OEIB school by school for every school in Oregon and use that at subcommittees. It might be interesting to do that on a more global basis. Big time stuff about downstream effects. I think we've referred to it a couple of times. Also, what programs are successful. Again, we've referred to that. And finally, I think it's really important to think about what achievements are really critical for future success, especially ones that we tend to think of as deficits, which turn out to be assets. OEIODE, Oregon Department of Ed's probably most significant revelation this past 12 months, based on research, was the following. If you are an English language learner, and you graduate from the English language program before ninth grade, you graduate high school at a higher rate than native English speakers, which says that bilingualism is a key event in your life, and it has effects on your learning and your proficiency in other curricular areas, and argues persuasively for dual language programs for all. And it also argues for rapidly getting students who don't speak English as a first language to be proficient in English as soon as possible, and definitely, if possible, before they get to high school. We didn't know that a year ago, and we learned that from Oregon longitudinal data. And there are other answers like that waiting to be answered by the SLDS, the Oregon Education Investment Board's SLDS. So I'll stop and just ask what kind of questions the subcommittee has.
Representative Nairwin, anything?
Yeah, it just occurred to me on that last point that you made there that your conclusion may not be correct about the ELL. It might be that the kids that are smart enough to finish it quickly are the kids that are smart enough then to graduate then. So it might be the tail wagging the dog on that. So it might not be that that there's some sort of advantage to learning two languages. I mean, not that I'm against people learning two languages or anything, but that just occurred to me. So.
Yeah, thanks for the constant reminder of the difference between correlation and causation. And one thing I'll just say is we do have the ability at ODE to control for their test scores on things like OAKS and all kinds of other demographic variables and things like that to try to narrow it down. But in the end, you're right, it's correlation, not causation.
Good. Thanks for your presentation.
And now that we have quite a variety of dual language programs very early, you'll also be able to see how that affects the English-speaking students who are in those dual language programs. And I think that's going to be significant. I have a grandson who's in a dual language program in Hillsborough, and I think it's going to be quite significant.
Yes, Senator Riley, and I'd be think about Mandarin programs growing and others that maybe are not as the first wave were more Spanish and French. So it'd be real interesting to see even differences in languages and the ultimate outcome way downstream. So
Thank you very much. If there's nothing else, we're going to adjourn. And thank you very much, everybody, for being here. And thank you very much, everybody, for being here. We're going to adjourn.